Okay, thank you. So my name's Dave Corbett from Strong Suits, and just by way of a bit of background, I've spent pretty much the best part of the last 25 years working with organisations like yours, public sector organisations, as well as all sorts of other organisations, to build really high-performing teams, and figuring out how do you overcome the many barriers to teams working extraordinarily well. So what I wanted to do this afternoon, I was asked, the brief I was given was to talk about teams in the context of an agile organisation. And I think the first thing I thought was, well, I know from experience that if I ask you what you mean by an agile organisation, we'll get quite a number of different answers. So what I thought I'd do is start by talking a little bit about the way that organisations are evolving and the way they're changing, because my experience, and it'd be very interesting to see if this is your experience, is that we're in the middle of a major shift of how we work, how we organise ourselves. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. So we've kind of got a mental framework to work in. And I always find it extremely useful as well when I work with clients that we have some kind of mental framework about the changes that we're making, not just in a specific sense for that organisation, but the wider context that we're operating in. And then I'll move on to talk about a number of ways that we can support teams in that kind of context, in the context of an agile organisation. And I can talk for England, so lots to say. And my problem's always shutting up, actually. But we'll stop at various points to kind of ask you about your views, because I'm really intrigued in, you know, what are your views about the sort of things I'm talking about. Let's build up a picture together of how do we support teams in agile organisations, okay? So, there we go. Don't know why I had that in there. I think that's because I had a nice picture, I thought I'd use it. So here we go. This is a picture of Henry Ford, the Ford production line in Detroit in 1913. You might think that's a very strange place to start, Dave, with talking about agile organisations and high-performing teams. But there's a point for showing that, and I'll explain what it is in a moment. But I've got a question for you, okay? So there's the motor car, a very important invention of the last sort of couple of centuries or so. You know, we all probably, you know, probably all own one pretty much. And if we don't own one, we probably use them quite often anyway. So the first question I want to ask you, and I'd like people to shout this out, is what do you think is the most important invention of the last 200 years? Just think of all the things you could think of. So what do you think? What's the most important invention of the last 200 years? The biro. It's definitely important. What else? The internet. So, sewage systems, extremely important. Yeah. Electricity. Yeah. Yeah. What else? Antibiotics. A lot of us wouldn't be here without those. That's absolutely true. What else? The microchip. Probably all got one in our pockets. Very sophisticated one. What else? One or two more things.
Telephone.
Yeah. And the mobile phone, I guess, as well, more latterly. And let's have one more. Actually, I've done similar workshops this with teenagers. The first thing they always say is the iPhone or something like that, smartphone. Yeah. What else? One more. The NHS. Okay. God bless them. Fabulous. So, I'm not saying this is the right answer, by the way, but I came across a piece of research a number of years ago which absolutely blew my mind, by a guy called Gary Hamel. And you may have heard of Gary Hamel. He was on the front cover of Time about 6-7 years ago. So he's kind of the sort of guy who's kind of quite well known, particularly in the States. He's an American kind of business guru. You know, he's got professorships all over the place. He's a visiting professor of business strategy at London Business School. And he says that his view is that the most important invention of the last 200 years is management, okay? And I thought, gosh, that's an interesting idea. And his view, the reason he gave for that, he said, look, you know, if you go back just 150 years, the average size of a company or an organisation in the UK was 4 people. So how many people here work in an organisation of 4 people or smaller? Put your hands up if you do. Not many of us. Most of us work in much bigger organisations. And his whole argument is, if you look at all the things we just mentioned, you know, sewage systems, antibiotics, the NHS, actually they didn't exist that time ago. And we actually had to figure out how to organise ourselves, because up until 150 years or so ago, we didn't need to organise ourselves in any significant numbers. And in fact, the only model we had for big organisations was generally armies. That was the model. And so when we started to do things like saying, let's sort out the sewers because the place stinks and people are getting ill, we had to figure out that needs thousands of people involved. How the hell do you do that? You know, I mean, if you're making a couple of cabinets or sewing some dresses, three or four people, you don't need organisation. You just do it. You just work together. But when you get to bigger tasks and bigger innovations, which is what we've had over the last 150, 200 years, you need to learn how to organise yourself. So there's a kind of, it blew my mind, the idea that management is an invention, actually. It's not something that just happened. We had to figure out how to do it. And the reason I'm going on about this and talking about a kind of bit of a history lesson is because my view is that we're actually in the middle of a revolution, a complete paradigm shift in how we organise ourselves. Now, this isn't the shift behind me. This is a shift that some of us are probably old enough to remember. Some of you won't be old enough to remember this. But if I go back to early in my career, and this is certainly true if you go back 150 years, that the way we organised ourselves is that somebody was in charge and told everyone else what to do. And everyone else just did what the white man who went to the appropriate school told them to do, because it always was a white man who went to the right school. And, you know, all of the women in the school, in this room, you wouldn't have been the person in charge. You definitely wouldn't have been in charge, would you? I wouldn't have been in charge because I didn't go to the right school. That's the way things worked. And actually, it seems quite archaic now, although actually achieved a lot. I mean, we did actually build the roads and get the sewers going, and actually most of the things we just mentioned happened as a result of us organising ourselves in that way. But it wasn't fair, and it wasn't kind to people, and it actually wasted a humongous amount of talent. And actually, it also embedded a way of working that was incredibly inefficient. You know, it didn't challenge the status quo. It wasn't innovative in the way we think of today. So sometime in the last sort of 50 to 70 years, we started to change that model of how we work. We shifted from what I call a conformance model, sometimes we call it a compliance model, where the head honcho, white guy usually, told people what to do and everyone said, yes, sir. And that's how it worked on Henry Ford's line. And actually, it was great. You know, it worked because most of the people coming to work on Henry Ford's production line were illiterate and had been working in the fields until a few weeks before. And they didn't have a clue about what to do. And they need somebody to say, just, you know, when that goes ping, tighten that knob. And they just did it. And he didn't want people asking why, because he stopped the production line. But that starts to then get in the way. So we invented a different way of organising ourselves, which we call the performance model. And actually, those of us in the room that are kind of probably older than about 40, 45, probably remember, I remember the first organisation I worked for. I worked for GEC. People remember GEC? The biggest company in the UK at the time. I don't know where it is now. I don't think it really exists anymore. And that's kind of how it worked. You know, you had certain people in charge, and if you asked questions like I did, it wasn't welcome. It was, you're causing trouble, you know? And all of the people in charge were white men who went to the right sort of school. Largely, not maybe by that stage entirely. And actually, a lot of us have been through this transition to a different way of working, where we said, actually, okay, you know, maybe we do need somebody in charge, but let's do it on merit. We create a meritocracy. We figure out who's really good at stuff. We put them in charge, and they tell everyone else what to do. So it's still a hierarchy. It's still about people telling other people what to do, but actually you achieve more results. You start to release a little bit more talent. But of course, it has a limitation. So who's seen this statistic before? Imagine a lot of people, you know. Actually, I was thinking when, is it Dilbert this morning? Lindbert was talking about, you know, why is inclusion important for organisations? This figure actually pops into my mind. Because actually the vast majority of people in organisations actually pretty disengaged. They feel that their talent isn't fully utilised. And many of you in this room may feel the same way. I certainly know when I run workshops and I'm working with small groups, I'll ask that question. And, you know, a lot of people feel, you know what, I know what to do. I know what to do. And if only my boss would listen to me, I could do it. But my boss doesn't know what to do. Because what we do when we create this performance paradigm is we divide things up into little chunks. And we put the most capable person in charge. And, of course, that most capable person doesn't actually know about the job you're doing on the front line. So can't see the issues. And so we've solved some problems. We've now got a meritocracy. but it's still a hierarchy. And that's why we end up with a situation where a lot of people at work, despite their talents, despite the huge variety of talents they have, feel disengaged, feel that they what they have to offer isn't included. I thought the talk this morning, by the way, was absolutely fabulous. That shift from equal opportunity to inclusion, I think, is so key. So that's history so far. That's what's been going on. And many of us, you can probably still see the remnants of that. I go into organisations, even now, where there is a remnant of a conformist culture. There are certain things you can't challenge because it's always been done that way, and that's the way we've always done it. And why would you want to change it? Yeah? People get that? And actually, you know, this is a kind of sensitive area, but you will know, many of you will know, that your talents aren't included because you're not the right gender or the right colour or went to the right school, even there. But we're in the middle of something I think quite marvellous, and I've heard it this morning in all the talks that I've listened to, where we're in the middle of another paradigm shift, where we're starting to shift to a more agile culture. Sometimes I call this a collaborative culture, sometimes I call it an agile culture, but it's a shift in the way we think about the way we organise ourselves. So if the thought at the conformance level is tradition and rules are what matter, you know, you've always been in charge, so you stay in charge, then, you know, that's the way we think when we're at that level. And that starts to get in the way. So we invent a paradigm that says, actually, what really matters, some people are more capable than others, so let's test them and put the most capable people in charge. And that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, a lot of you will be in senior positions and positions of responsibility because you're really capable. And you might have been through an assessment process where it was assessed that your capability was more than someone else's. So a lot of us in this room are beneficiaries of that paradigm. But it gets in the way. So we've started, and I'm seeing this emerge in all sorts of different places. Every single one of the talks I've heard this morning has contained this shift. So we're shifting to a paradigm where we realise, yes, some people are more capable than others. We're not denying that. But nobody is as capable as everybody. Whatever we do, no matter how capable you are, you know, you could be a genius, Einstein or whatever, but you're not going to be as capable as the whole collective of all the different people. And that's not just about capability in the conventional sense. It actually goes back to the beach ball that Ed was talking about this morning. No individual in this room, no small group of people in this room can actually see the whole picture. So actually, we're starting to create organisations that recognise none of us is as capable as everybody. And actually, we can work in a different way that allows all of those viewpoints, all of those experiences, all of those different talents to be included, and we'll actually what we can achieve from that point of view is more. Is this making sense to people so far? Kind of seeing quite a few nods. I'm trying to see to the back there. Are you nodding? Brilliant. So that's the kind of history lesson. I won't go through all the details here, but there's, you know, each level. You know, none of these are bad. I'm not saying being conformist or being focused on performance is a bad thing. You need them. You can't build an agile culture unless you've got a certain ground rules of how we behave, certain expectations that people you can rely on. You know, we don't want to kind of create an agile children's services and then people say, oh, no, I didn't. Or an agile surgery unit in a hospital. And the surgeon says, oh, I don't think I'll bother washing my hands. Don't fancy it today. We don't want that. We want certain things that we conform to. But we don't want to just be about conformance. And then we create a performance culture where we measure things and we figure out what works. And that adds more. It allows us to achieve more. But it starts to get in the way. Because one of the things we do when we create a performance culture is we split things up. We say, okay, you manage this bit, you manage that bit, and then we're really surprised when you don't work together because you're measured in a way that actually says don't collaborate, compete. And so we end up with fragmentation, we end up with disengagement, and that's why we need to develop this new way of working. So, and I'm telling you this as a backdrop, because when we talk about agile, I go into organisations that absolutely get that. They really get it. And lots of things are changing. Not just... I also go into other organisations where agile kind of becomes code for kind of, you know, working mobile and kind of working from home. And it's just about office space. Yeah. And actually what I see, and you know, there's lots and lots of evidence out there that I can give anyone who's interested. I won't go through it all today. That actually, if you really embrace the whole shift in mindset, shift in culture behind Agile, then there is so much more that is possible for all of us in our organisations. And I think pretty much everyone here is either in the public sector or kind of supporting the public sector. Am I right in that? Is that true? Certainly, as I work mostly with public, with local government and the NHS and a few other kind of national bodies. And what I see is the intractable problems that we face simply can't be solved from a performance mindset. But they can, or at least we can hold out the hope, that they can be solved from this agile, from this collaborative mindset. It's a shift in mindset, and it opens up more possibilities. So I think the challenge is, this is a quote from Peter Drucker actually, so much of what we call management is making it hard to get things done, making it difficult for people to work. So I just want to give you one example that, you know, if there was a point at which I personally got this, you know, I kind of been seeing this in organisations. You know, when as a consultant, I'm sure many consultants in this room, you kind of see things and you think, am I adding up 2 and 2 and making 5 here, or is there something going on? You know, and, you know, like a lot of consultants, are kind of go to lots of different places, go to lots of different conferences, speak to lots of different things, and you're trying to figure out where's the cutting edge, because that's actually where you need to be as a consultant. People don't want to know kind of what worked 10 years ago. They want to know what's going to be working in 2-3 years' time. And I saw a really interesting example. I was working with a large hospital, and they had a problem with delivering medicines to patients on time. Okay, so there's some medicines you can kind of give whenever you want. There are some, though, that if you don't give them on time, it kills people. Simple as that. So take antibiotics for septicemia. Yeah, we all know what septicemia is. Antibiotics are prescribed. And the guideline is you've got to give the antibiotic within an hour of the prescription, within an hour. And in this particular hospital, they were achieving something, well, they were missing 23% of the time. So 23% of the time, it was over an hour. And if you look at the figures, you know, if you deliver the antibiotics within an hour, it's 99% effective. Within 2 hours, it's 90% effective. Within 3 hours, it's 50% effective. So you're going to kill people if you miss those doses. And there've been a huge program, this thing called the care of the acutely ill patient, you know, where the great and the good, the people at the head of the performance culture, were charged with eliminating this difficulty. And it had been going on for about a year when I got involved. And it had, you know the sort of thing. You were familiar with this, you know, complex project plans with, I mean, I remember seeing this action plan that was on A3, and it must have been 6-point type with all the actions that they were going to do. Nothing had changed. In fact, if anything, it got slightly worse. So we ran a workshop with kind of everybody. You know, we just figured out, okay, who's involved in this whole chain of delivering medicines to patients? And it starts with, you know, often the pharmacy, and then you've got the nurses, you've got the junior doctors, lots of different people who touch that whole chain. We just got them in a room together and said, what's really going on? And there was quite a complex conversation going on. And then one of the nurses said, you know what the real problem is? We do a trolley round for the medicines, and because the way the wards have been rearranged and they've squeezed more beds in, it takes more than an hour to go around. So just think about it. You've got to deliver the medicines in an hour. It takes longer than an hour to go around. You're automatically building in. It won't work. And she'd actually said this to her boss, I think it was the matron, a year before when this had been talked about. And the matron had thought, that's interesting. What she wanted to do was split the trolley round in half. And the matron said, oh, that's a really good idea. I'm not quite sure we're allowed to do that, because there are all sorts of restrictions around. It had got passed to her boss, who was the general manager, who'd said, that's a good idea. I'd have to take it to... And it had ended up as performance and quality, at the performance and quality board. I can tell you, in that particular organisation, every time anyone mentioned performance and quality board, everyone, because nothing happened. And I'm being really polite there, actually. I want to use harsher words than that. And you've been in those sort of meetings when nothing happens. And actually, this suggestion had made it all the way up to performance and quality board, which was full of the, you know, it was the medical director and the chief surgeon, and it was all the great and the good. And they looked at it and said, why are we looking at this? We're strategic. And so they'd not bothered with it. So it got in the way. So there's a great example of how if you shift the culture, and this is what we were doing in this hospital, we're shifting the culture to something a little bit. Anyone who was in the peer coaching just now, peer coaching, what they were talking about, where people feel empowered to actually make decisions and move things forward. So this is really what we're talking about here. And there's a whole range of things that we can do to support teams so that teams feel they can get on with things. So I should check the time because I've been talking for quite a while and I don't know whether I've got time to go through this case study. Yeah, I probably haven't actually. But notice the name Bert Zorg. Who in the room has heard of Bert Zorg? One or two hands there. If you do nothing else after this presentation, go and Google them and look them up. I will tell you a little bit. So Bert Zorg was a company formed, I think only about 10 years ago, forget the exact date, and in Holland, Dutch company, and at the time, their social care system, very similar to ours, you know, where you've got managers who run social care and you've got help, you know, carers and so on who go out and help. It's mainly sort of, this was mainly to do with like elderly people in their homes who need help kind of dressing and washing or, you know, open a can of beans for their lunch or whatever. And everyone hated it. Very similar to this country. I actually found out about this company during a time when my mum was in the last stages of life and she needed a lot of elderly social care at home. And it was very interesting to see the parallels in the UK. Everyone hated it. The nurses hated it and the care workers hated it because they would just be given a list of like who they've got to go to. It's like you've got 6 minutes with Mrs. Jones and then you've got to get across town and you've got 3 minutes for that to see Mrs. Smith. And then you get to Mrs. Smith and you've got 4 minutes, you know. And it's like, bloody hell, I don't... probably not, shouldn't have said that, should I? But it's not what people needed. You know, they would turn up at Mrs. Jones and she'd say, actually, I don't want my dressing changed today because I feel fine. But what I really need a hand with is I can't get this thing out of the top of a cupboard. But, you know, the computer list out said no. The managers hated it because they knew everyone actually doing the frontline work weren't really making an impact. And the customers, the clients, the patients hated it because they weren't getting the care they wanted. And this guy, Jos Burstein, who had been in this system as a nurse and had learnt something about this paradigm shift, said, I'm going to create an organisation that works completely differently. And the way Bert Zorg works is that a group of 10 to 12 community nurses or care workers get together and they decide what they're going to do. They don't have a manager. They don't have somebody telling them what to do. They figure out amongst themselves, what do we need to do to take care of our mainly old people they were caring for. And everyone loves it. The nurses, the care workers love it. The satisfaction levels from the people being cared for went up through the roof. Actually, they got much better care, but the costs went down. It's kind of miraculous, that, isn't it? The costs went down. But here's the really interesting statistic. So Bert Zorg grew in a period of 10 years from one team of 10 people to having 10,000 care workers and nurses, providing well over half of the care to all elderly people in Holland. And they did that purely through organic growth. And at the end of that, and they're probably bigger now. I mean, I got those statistics 2 or 3 years ago. They're probably 20,000 people now, I don't know. But, you know, they went from not 10 to 10,000 people. And what would you imagine, how many managers or non-frontline workers might they have? So I'll give you an example. So in the NHS, I looked at the figures, and I think 12% of people in the NHS are... I mean, this is not even thinking about people involved in estates and all those sort of things, but are managers of some sort, 12%. What would you think the figure is in Bert Zorg? 10,000 people. Anyone have a guess? One. It was actually, they had 30 non-frontline staff. And of those 30, most of them were running the IT to make sure the people on the front line had the information they needed to make the decisions that they were making. Now, I'm not suggesting this is the way we go. I mean, it may be the way we go, but this is just showing there is a different way of working where actually there was an article written about this company that said it was on the front page of the Harvard Business Review, and the title was First Get Rid of All the Managers. Now, that freaks people out, especially if you've got the word manager in your title. But it's a thought about how do we shift the power to make decisions, the power to make things happen, much more to the front line, much closer to the point where it actually makes a difference. Because all of those steps that would normally happen, you know, where, you know, this group behind me want to change the rotor or something, would normally go through a manager who goes to their manager, who goes to their manager, and then suddenly it becomes performance and quality board. And of course, it doesn't happen. And even if it does happen, it probably happens in a way that actually doesn't work to solve the original problem in the first place. So it's a different way of working. So that's a bit of background about a different way of working. And I want to move on to talk about, okay, so in that different paradigm, if we kind of want to realise the full potential of this agile shift, this shift in mindset, how do we support teams in that? But before we move into that, I want to just pause and ask you, what are the challenges that the teams you're supporting are wrestling with? So what have you come here today to learn or to find out, or where you want an extra tool in the context of the sort of people that you're supporting? So what I'd like you to do is just have a two-minute conversation on your tables. Just see if you can come up with one thing, and then we'll shout those out and we'll see how that looks in terms of the rest of the presentation. Okay, let's hear a few things that came out of your conversations then. What are the challenges you're wrestling with? And I'll start with the tables at the back there. So just shout out one thing that came up in your conversation. Silo working, yeah. Okay, there's a little ripple across the room then. It's like, yeah, right over there, right at the back. Yeah, just tell us one thing. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's the infrastructure, the stuff that wraps around those teams. Yeah. And again, a lot of people... A lot of people nodding there. Okay. What else? This table here. Presenteeism. Okay. Just say a word or two more, just so we all understand the same thing. Need to be seen. Okay. As opposed to actually getting something done. Yeah. Yeah. What about you guys? Second table up. Say that again. Austerity. Oh, okay, kind of resources, being asked to do ever more with ever less. I think that came up here, didn't it? I overheard you guys talking about that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, here. Yeah. Right. Okay. So it's like the inertia of the current way of doing things almost, is it? Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 I mean, you have, I guess, a particular challenge in that you can't just make stuff up, can you? You are there for the rules for the rest of us. Interesting challenge. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah? Yeah. Fabulous. Thank you. Yeah? Right. Yeah. Quality of the relationships. Yeah. Right. Okay. That's a good question. Yeah. 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 So just in case you can't hear, gentleman is saying about the kind of what's the magic number in terms of the ratio of managers to people managed, and you're saying it's like 4-1? 4-1. Okay, that's interesting. And then finally, you guys.
I think sometimes it's not understanding the expectations, so people are resistant to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
As social worker, I want to move from being 20% in front of the customer, where like 80% on the computer, and I want to flip that to
80% with. Right, okay. Yeah.
That's a big, massive challenge.
It's a massive shift.
This whole infrastructure about just reporting.
Yeah, yeah. And where does that add value? Yes. Yeah. 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 I'm guessing people at the back can't hear what this gentleman's saying. He's saying about he's surprised that the stress and mental health hasn't come up, in the sense of the stresses that people are under, and that's often the first thing that breaks. Okay, so I'm kind of going to touch on all those things, and I could almost do it like a day, really, on this, if I'm honest. As you're talking there, it's like I could do like an hour and a half on each for each table, if I'm honest. But we'll skip through a few things that this is kind of like the highlights of when I go into organisations. Where do I start? What am I looking at? And pretty much everything you've mentioned there is stuff that's included in that. So I want to talk about five things, really. And this isn't, there's different ways of dicing this. I could start with the stuff that wraps around the organisation. And in fact, there's a little leaflet floating around my company, and one of the things on there is about the Agile Organisational Review, and it's about exactly that. It's about how do we understand the subtle ways in which we either support this way of thinking or we get in the way. So I'll give you a really simple example. I go to lots of organisations where I walk in meeting rooms and there's a big fat table stuck in the middle. So people can't actually work in a way that is actually collaborative, is agile. It's set up for the head honcho to stand at the end of the table and tell everyone else what to do. This room, as I walked in this room, I kind of thought, oh my God, I'd much rather the screen was over there because I want to be in the middle. I don't want to be like at the end. I want us to be having a conversation. So just, and there's, we have a whole approach, which I'm not going to really say, it'll come up in the conversation about the six different ways that we support or get in the way of people are working in an agile way. But the things that I do want to talk about, and I have no idea why it's coming up in that order. There we go. Purpose and people. Learning and empowerment. Communication and trust. Standards and accountability. And strengths and diversity. And I thought I'd put that in plain English. Because to be quite honest, you know, we all use words like that and we kind of have to. And I go to deliver tender presentations and those are the sort of words I use. But actually, what I really want to do is talk in terms that people understand. And this second slide is more, you know, how I understand. I want, you know, what I find when I'm working with teams, they're really wrestling with is this whole issue of we know what impact we're trying to make. You know, the point you made about wanting to spend more time with the clients. You know, what impact does doing all this reporting make? Other than actually it just takes up loads of time and stops us doing our jobs. You know, but somehow, you know where that comes from? Because you've got somebody up here who doesn't see the impact of actually not being with the client. So they're not thinking about the client. They're thinking about, I'll talk about this a little bit later, they're thinking about who's above them, not who's, below is the wrong word, but where we actually add value, which is with the client. There's often a lot of stuff, and in fact, in some ways, most of this comes down to a shift in mindset, a different way of thinking, a way of thinking that says, actually, we can change, we can learn, and actually, feeling like I can get on and do something about it. You know, the reason that 70% of the workforce is disengaged is because they can see the problems in front of them and often feel utterly disempowered, like, I can't do anything about it. And maybe, you know, if they were kind of super skillful, they could persuade their boss, but maybe they just want to tell their boss, look, come on, there's a problem here, fix it, please. Yeah, and we're going to talk about the way some organizations actually embed that in, shift the whole thing on its head. So I call customer patient or customer facing accountability rather than upward facing accountability. People trust each other and they can say what they need to say. I mean, how often, you know, do we work in situations where the things that really need to be said are the very things that never get said? And when we create a culture, and this is, you know, in my view, this is always like the number one test for me when I look at the chief exec of the organisation. I'm picky about who I work with. I learned a long time ago, you know, whether I do a good job or not is not down to me. It's down to you, you know. So I'm always looking like, is this an organisation that can actually make some real difference? Because if it is, I'll work with you. I'll probably end up, you'll do all the work and you'll say, I've done a great job. But if I work with an organisation that doesn't really want to change, I'll work bloody hard, and then it doesn't work because you didn't really want to do it, and then you'll say, the consultant let us down, you know. So I learned a long time ago, I kind of vet my clients. And one of the number one thing I always look for is, are the people at the top creating an environment where people can say what they need to say? Are they actively inviting that in a way that people feel, yeah, I can say what I need to say because I know that people are going to, there's a level of trust. I've got a little bit to say about standards. You might be surprised about that. It feels a bit more like the performance paradigm, but there are some shifts in mindset around what we mean by standards that happen when we make this shift to a more agile organisation. And then finally, each person playing to their strengths and respecting different roles. And in fact, I'm just going to go back slide because I'm going to change one word on this presentation. So this is me learning in action from this morning. I want to change the bottom word to inclusion. I realise that's the wrong word, isn't it, actually? It's not about diversity, it's about inclusion. And I'm really grateful for what was said this morning. That was like a real penny drop moment for me. But it still applies. So, purpose and people. It's about making an impact, not just doing a task. Exactly as you were saying. And it's a shift. I go into organisations where I sit down with people and we talk about what they're doing and what they tell, or what the differences they're trying to make. And you're all coaches, so you know the importance of the subtlety of these questions. And what they tell me about is what they're doing. They don't tell me about the difference they're making. And I can point to organisations where 80% of their capacity is doing stuff that doesn't actually make an impact. And it's kind of shocking sometimes. That doesn't mean people aren't working really hard. Often, those are the organisations where people work the hardest. And in fact, when I go into an organisation where I hear that everyone is working super hard, my spidey senses go, are these people tuned into impact? Because it sounds like they're tuned into tasks. And is anyone here working in the NHS before I insult you? So I do a lot of work in the NHS, and I've got utmost respect for people who work in the NHS. But the NHS is pretty much addicted to task, not impact. You know, there is so much in the NHS that does not add any value for anyone. It sucks value out. And if that one change, you know, you could, I reckon, this is just my, you know, I've sat down with various chief executives and had conversations. You could take 30% of the NHS budget and recycle it back into treating patients and actually making a difference to patients if you thought in this way. Now, it's not going to solve the problem of the NHS, actually, because 30% probably buys us about 5 years, but it gives us another 5 years to figure out how the hell to fix the NHS. So that's really important. And this is just about a shift in mindset. One of the things I'm listening for my clients is, where's your focus of attention? Because if you're running around like the proverbial, you know, the chances are you're being focused, and it may be the wraparounds, you know, the way the organisation works, that the organisation measures what you do rather than the impact you make. But this is what we've got to change. And this is what actually makes a difference. Has anyone here ever been up to Wigan recently? Wigan Council. Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Have you done the New Deal program, the deal program? Go before Donna Hall disappears, because she's a saint in my view, go and visit Donna Hall. She's the chief exec of Wigan Council. She has made a dramatic impact on what's happening. She's really making a dramatic impact on everything across Greater Manchester because, and it's not the only thing, she focuses on impact, not task. And she's given the whole of her workforce the opportunity and the space to say, I'm not going to do that because it doesn't make any difference. I want to do this because it does make a difference. And it puts the citizen, the patient, the customer in front of us rather than someone up here that we're reporting to. I know we can't entirely do that. Some of you will be sat here in jobs where your job is to report to people. And I get that. You know, there's got to be a balance. But we have to redress that balance. It's out of kilter at the moment. So here's another one. So this is actually, I stole this diagram from a website called holocracy.com. Again, go and have a look at it. I'm not saying it's the answer, but it's a different way of thinking, and it's a great website. It's very well put together, and I really like, you know, people who kind of give away that amount of information. It helps all of us. It's very generous. And one of the key ideas they want to talk about is an idea I see, again, a lot in organisations. How do we organise ourselves? Do we start by thinking about the people, as in, like, how senior people are, or do we start with the task? So the example I gave you earlier on, and I could give you 1,000 examples of this, you know, you could give me 1,000 examples easily in the next 10 minutes if you wanted to, where there's some big challenge we've got, and we organise ourselves, and I'm doing a piece of work at the moment with two other hospitals who are trying to integrate their stroke units. And they have an operational group, which is all the people actually do the work. You know, it's the doctors, the nurses, the therapists. And they meet, and they decide what they want to do. And then they have a separate meeting, which they call the program board, which is all the great and the good, who have a completely different conversation. And it's insane. It's like, because the people here say, well, like, say, here's an example. Where this is, I'm just suddenly self-conscious, this is going to be on the web, and I hope they don't listen to this. I'm not really being critical of them. It's kind of like they're trapped in the paradigm we're currently in, like we all are. But, you know, one of the examples they gave, they want the same dashboard. You know, they're measuring performance in one place, measuring performance in another place, and it'd really help them to have a single dashboard. And the group people who do the work get together and say, we really want a single dashboard. Can we get on with it? And the people up here have a conversation and say, oh, I don't know. It would mean money going from here to here, and we need to thought, you know. And so they can't get on with it. And they're not in the same room to actually even hear the arguments, to hear what's really going on. So we need to change things. And there we go. Oh, it's at the top. Sorry, I missed it there. Organise the work, not the people. That doesn't mean not organise the people. It just means start with what you're trying to do and then figure out who you need around the table. And it might be you have got the chief executive and the cleaner, you know, and that's fine if those are the people who are actually needed. What we normally do is we say, oh, hang on, this meeting involves the chief executive. We can't have anyone below director level because that would somehow be wrong. But nobody below director level, above director level, actually knows what the problem is. So you end up having a conversation. I've sat there. We're like talking about something really important, like how do we deliver medicines on time? Nobody in the room knows because they don't actually do ward rounds anymore. And it's not that they don't care. They really care, but they're not there. But somebody who's very junior, you know, it's a kind of not even a nurse. It's kind of, what do you call them? It's the people who wear green. There's different grade, isn't it? Care assistants or something, you know. It's the green nurses as opposed to the blue nurses, you know what I mean. You know, doesn't know the problem, because she actually takes the trolley around and gets, oh, hang on a minute, it takes me an hour and a half to take the trolley around. Why can't we just change it? I'm not allowed to. Oh, I don't feel allowed to. I don't feel safe to. Yeah, and then one of the other shifts, it's, again, I see a lot, you know, plans. I mean, you need plans, you know. Going on holiday, you've got to have a sense how you get there. But you know what? Plans don't really work. We all know that. You know, you make a plan, and at the end of day one, you're already off the plan because something came up you didn't think of, and it didn't work out how you thought. So we've got to start thinking in terms of navigation, yeah? Like, if I'd come here today, and I thought, I've got a plan, I know exactly how I'm going to turn the wheel at each stage, I'd have driven off the road, you know, and I probably wouldn't have got here because there was a flood on one of the roads. You have to constantly be... And it's embedded in our thinking. You know, I go into organisations, it's got big, thick plans, and I think, it doesn't make sense. It's not the way we actually get things done. So I'll skip over that because I'm going to go on too long. So the next thing I want to talk about, and I probably should have maybe started with this, is what I call the agile mindset. It's this, I mean, this is all about mindset, but it's kind of, this is specifically the specific way of thinking. And first part of that, there's lots of different ways of expressing this. Each one of us could come up with our own version of this, and they'd all be valid, and they'd all kind of say the same thing. So I'm not saying this is the right way. It's the way I remember it. So it's kind of like a mental checklist when I'm working with people. And these three things always come up. So the first thing is that this idea, you know, many of you in the room will have read the book Mindsets, yeah, which is all about the first bubble there, that failure is an opportunity for growth. It doesn't mean I can't change. You know, this idea that, you know, people read this book, Carol Dweck. It's, again, a great book. If you haven't read it already, read it. It's a fantastic book. It's all about, she did a load of work with children, and she realised that in terms of their education, there were some kids who, when they did a maths test and they couldn't do it, their thought process was, I need to work harder. I need to figure out how to solve those sort of problems, yeah? It's a growth mindset. I can get better. But there are other kids, and these were the kids who were failing, who they failed the maths test and thought, I can't do maths. So they didn't bother trying. They didn't bother doing the learning because they had a fixed mindset. And I see that, again, a lot in organisations. We tell ourselves stories. I'm not the sort of person that can do this. Or the organisation tells itself a story, you know, about what it can and can't do. I think the NHS at the moment is kind of pretty much in the grip of a story that says we can't get out of this hole. And you know what? If they think that, they're definitely right. I don't know whether the NHS can get out of the hole it is, but I know damn well the only way you're going to get out of the hole is by thinking you can and scrabbling around trying to find a way. And there are people doing that, thank God. The second part there, the bit in pinky red, is you've got to connect decision-making as close to the point of the issue, the challenge, the difference it can make as you can. You know, so often in organisations, you know, some trivial decision has to go through all sorts of layers and we can't get anything done. And actually, when we do make a decision, it's so disconnected from the real issue that actually it's not the right decision. It's not necessarily wrong. It's not. In fact, it's a phrase I sometimes use, like, not even wrong. Like when I'm talking about the NHS a lot this morning for some reason, it's on my mind, but you know, when Jeremy Hunt announced the formation of the CCGs, you know, I was deeply involved in a number of acute trusts at the time, and I remember one of the chief execs saying, it's not even wrong, it's like it's not near enough the problem to even be the wrong solution. It's irrelevant, you know. And then the bubble at the bottom there is, I would say, the key shift, you know, is I've already said I want you to look at Bert Zorg and buy Carol Dweck's book. But I think if there's one thing you remember from this presentation is this shift in mindset to nobody is as capable as everybody. And again, I want to just pause there, just give myself a breath, give you your ears a little bit of rest. Just spend 2 minutes. Ask yourself this question. Oh, I'm going to skip forward a little bit because there's too many slides. You can look at the slides. I think the slides are going to be available later, so there's a few more slides. But if we actually acted as if nobody is as capable as everybody, we really took that to be the case, what would change about the way we work? Okay, and by everybody, I mean everybody, by the way. I don't mean like the people we think are any good. I mean everybody. So like in Wigan, they will ask people with severe difficulties, you know, their lives are off the rails, what are their views and what do they want? And they take them seriously. And there were some absolutely miraculous stories coming out of that place of amazing things happening just because they acted, really acted, spoke from, worked from. Nobody is as capable as everybody. And that includes the person in front of me who looks like they haven't got any capability at all. But you take it seriously and something happens. So 2 minutes, just see if you can come up with what would change about the way we work if we took that seriously. Yeah? Is that okay? Okay, so let's just hear one or two, I won't go around all the tables this time, just hear one or two things. What would change about the way we work if we really acted as if nobody is capable as everybody? What do you reckon? Are you putting your hand up there? No. Yeah. 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 You'd really, so real co-production, co-creation, and then that has all sorts of positive knock-on effects. You get the right, you know, better answers to problems. What else? Yeah. Stop getting in the way. Yeah. What else? One more thing.
Ego.
Ego. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So many of the challenges we have are actually ultimately about people's egos getting in the way. We don't take the right decision. We take a decision that actually boosts someone's ego or avoids a dent in somebody's ego. Yeah. And actually, it doesn't mean that people's particular talents. I mean, I've worked with some people who've got extraordinary talents, off the scale in different ways. It doesn't mean those things aren't included. They are included, but they're alongside everything else. And actually, it means everyone shines rather than just one or two people. And then everyone else feeling like my view's not worth it. So, I want to talk about, a little bit more about... I'm going to skip over a little bit, most of this stuff about communication and trust. I mean, it's incredibly important. And in fact, you know, I hesitate to... I should count at some point how many teams I've worked with, but it's definitely in the thousands. And one of the questions I almost always ask right at the beginning is, like, what are the big challenges you've got? And I can't think of a single occasion when a team hasn't included communication or trust or some combination of those in the top three. And it's often the top one. You know, like, if you haven't got that, it is the biggest problem you've got. You know, it's you have to do something about it because you can't solve any of these other problems unless you have an ability to have an honest conversation. And that applies culturally as well, not just to individual teams. And you can see that when you go into an organisation, you know, that sense of when people can't actually say what they need to say. It's, you know, you're talking about mental health and stress. You know, the mental health issues come to the fore. And in fact, one of the things I really liked about the presentation on peer coaching was the fact they'd set that up largely as an outlet for people to be able to say the things they needed to say. And I think that's really absolutely to be applauded. But, yeah, this is the slide I really wanted to focus on. What do you think it's going to say? You laugh there. What do you think it's going to say? Listening, exactly, yeah. You know, I mean, again, it came up this morning, doesn't it? You know, we're all happy to talk. I'm certainly happy to talk. But actually, the thing that really makes the difference is the listening. You know, I mean, I spend quite a lot of my time with groups of people. I'm not always dealing with really difficult issues, but often dealing with really difficult issues, the issues they haven't been able to explore. And it's a difficult conversation because there's a certain level of discomfort. And, of course, I might be with a group of 10 people, maybe for an hour. You work it out, it's like 6 minutes each. You know, in fact, it's probably less because I'll take up at least 5 minutes kind of framing it or something, you know. And I've definitely had people say, well, this is a bit of a waste of time, I'm not going to get to say much. But actually, it's the listening. The quality of the listening is what actually produces a transformation in the way the team works. I had an incident just literally on Friday where I was working with two people who are in pretty major conflict at the top of an organisation. And there was a moment when one of them really got, I mean, like, really got the concerns, the pain, actually the fear of the other person. And they both broke down in tears, actually, but it was utterly transformative. And it happened because after years of seeing each other as the enemy, one of them was actually able to listen. Really able to listen. You know, listening isn't something you do with your ears, it's something you do with your whole body. And when you listen with your whole body, you know, the world really changes. And I see that in organisations, it's something I do with teams, getting them to listen with their whole body. And you can actually feel your own emotional reaction to what people are saying, and it changes things. And for me, this is again, there's so many things that change. But a lot of this is holographic. You know, you change what you don't. It seems like a long list of things I'm going through, doesn't it? I'm only really talking about one thing. They're all the same thing, but viewed from different points of view. You know, if you change the way people listen, an awful lot changes. And in fact, if you take seriously this idea that nobody's as capable as everybody, you know, one of the things that changes is you don't have to listen more. You don't have to listen more. So, there we go. Oh, I quite like this, actually. But this is a bit of fun. So this was just a random study I found. I think it was McKinsey or someone, and they were looking at this whole issue of communication. And they, you know, these really large studies where tens of thousands of people are involved are always really valuable, aren't they? Because they give you some real data, you know. And they're very good at this in the States. And this was, I think it was, what's the name of the really huge insurance company? Is it Axon or something like AXA? Anyway, biggest insurance company in the world. Used to sponsor Man United, just run down their shirts. And they, just as an experiment, they tried changing things so that teams that work together had to take coffee breaks at the same time. That was the only change. Didn't have to sit together, didn't have to have a coffee together. They just had to have a coffee break at the same time. So like if you were a team here, you all take a coffee break at 11 o'clock rather than some of you going early, some of you going late. And performance in the teams where they did it went up by 8%. And it was like measurable. It was like they were doing quite concrete, measurable things. I find that just staggering. And when they dug into it, of course, it was because people actually talk to each other. It's that simple. They actually talk to each other. I think so many of the challenges we have in the workplace now is because we don't actually have that time. you know, we don't take the time, and again it was mentioned this morning, just to actually be with other people without an agenda. You know, the agenda actually often gets in the way. So there you go. Go and have a cup of coffee together. That's my top tip for today. So, I will talk about this. Yeah, I mean, again, it's something, you know, I talk about a lot in organisations. You know, I go into organisations and there's so little opportunity for informal interaction. But some of the best work happens, some of the best ideas, some of the resolutions of difficulties between people, and some of the best relationships form because people can just interact without an agenda. So one of the things I'm constantly encouraging organisations, so I'm working with an organisation at the moment that's about to move offices, and they've just seen it as like something they had to get through, you know. But I've been working with them to figure out, okay, how do they not just co-locate, I mean, co-location I think is something that's fairly mainstream these days, but how do they create lots of opportunities for people to just interact in informal ways, little places to sit down, places to have coffee, so it isn't always a formal meeting. And again, the impact, you know, you can look at the evidence, that's why I talked about the coffee cup thing, is enormous. You know. So, lots more I can say there. So, I just want to say a little bit about distributed teams, because I imagine some of you will be, you know, heard the word agile and thought we're talking about teams in lots of different places. Is that true for you? Yeah. So I thought I'd better specifically address this. So I think that, you know, these are some of the things that I found really important. So one is about, obviously, the IT makes a massive difference. Again, we heard it a little bit earlier, if anyone was in the peer learning presentation, about using IT. They were using IT to support coaching groups. And again, I work with my clients, and one of the things I get them to do is think about, okay, you want people to work flexibly. Let's make sure they've got the ability to reconnect with people when they're not physically there. You know, you need, and you do need to coordinate some time together, you know, particularly in teams that are kind of aren't naturally coming together in some other way. And even if they are, if it's a formal team meeting with updates and reports, It you need the space, the informal interaction. So I always encourage teams to organise time together, even if it's only by video, you know, using things like Zoom or, you know, Skype or whatever. It's incredible how much difference it makes. I think you've got to invest in the kickoff. You know, when you bring a team together, you've got to accelerate through that. We all know the model, you know, the, you know, forming, storming, norming and performing. Actually, you've got to accelerate through that. Don't let it just happen, because it might not actually fully happen. You might get stuck at some earlier stage. And so it's really worthwhile investing at the very beginning in putting some time into newly forming teams. And a lot of it is actually, I mean, some of it will be about the stuff we already talked about, understanding what's the impact we're trying to make, understanding how we're going to communicate. But actually just something as simple as getting to know something about each other as people makes an enormous difference. I mean, I did some work a number of years ago with the executive team of a bank. I don't do a lot of work in the private sector, but I was working with a large bank. And I discovered that despite the fact that I think the newest member of the team had been there 3 years, I discovered that one of the members of the team had been represented Britain in the Commonwealth at swimming. And I also discovered that nobody else in the team knew that. So I got them just talking about, you know, stuff that nobody in the team knew about. And actually, and this is kind of really bizarre, two of the people in the team discovered that they were, one of them had lived in South Africa and come back to the UK, this is years ago, and one of them had been visiting South Africa, but they'd come by boat, and they discovered they'd been on the same boat. And they'd worked together for like 3 years and not known that. And of course, you do that, it creates a connection, it creates a bond. It allows us, it's actually part of the underpinning that allows us to have some of those more difficult conversations we otherwise don't have. And I'll say something about, I won't go into this, but, you know, the technology, there's so much good technology out there, and it really makes a difference. So I do collaborative projects. I'm working on a project at the moment that involves somebody in Hungary, somebody in India, somebody in the States, and there's also somebody in Australia. And we're doing everything using Zoom, using Slack, using Trello. There are hundreds of these tools. You can Google it and kind of look up similar tools, these online collaboration tools, and they make an enormous difference. And even if you're only distributed across a city or a town, different sides of the town, actually it can make an enormous difference. So do invest in the technology and get people using it. It really does work. So there's Zoom. So Yes, yeah, so here's a question for you. We all know what accountability is about doing what you say you will do. So in a good team, the boss holds people to account. What do you think the end of that second sentence is? In an agile team, we all hold each other to account. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, again, this shift of mindset. You know, so I'm kind of intrigued by your question about what's the ideal ratio. Well, I think the question actually kind of changes. Because, you know, I've seen teams where I've sat there and I've thought, you wouldn't know who the boss is. Because, you know, something comes up and people are holding each other to account. But, of course, you can only do that if you've got that bedrock of really good communication. Because if I say to you, have you finished that report you said you'd do? If you and I haven't got some sense of relationship, you're going to think, who the hell is he? Yeah. We need to know each other. And it's not difficult. You know, we kind of know this at one level, but we don't act like we know it. We act like people are machines, and we're not machines. We're people. We have emotions. We have feelings. Even the men. Actually, probably in some ways, especially the men. You know, I kind of really noticed that. A lot of men carry around a lot of emotions, but it's blocked inside. And so we all carry around these emotions, and we need to work in a way that respects that we are emotional beings. And how, you know, there was a quote up this morning, but Maya Angelou, you know, people will forget what you said, they'll forget what you did, they won't forget how you made them feel, you know. And part of that is about, I understand you as a person. I get something about your background and what's important to you. Hence the socialization stuff. Now, here, this is something I'm really passionate about. I didn't really invent this, but I kind of came across it. I was doing some research in this whole area of what's happening in organisations around the world. I could see it with my own clients. Something's emerging. So I started looking, like, around the world. Surely this is happening in other places, and it is. It's happening everywhere, actually. And in certain sectors, you look at the IT sector, or gaming, a really interesting one. You know, games, anyone here got teenage sons? Yeah. And they're all on the games all the time. Companies that make games for some reason have very innovative practices. And one of the things I found, and I've been introducing this, particularly in the NHS, is where does accountability flow? You know, if you think about it, what do we take to mean accountability? Generally, and if anyone wants to challenge me on this, it's fine. It flows upwards. You're thinking about accountable to your boss. But actually, there's a different way of thinking about it. You know, so there's a conventional organisation. So let's take, is that no one here got shares in BT, have they? My favourite company, you know. You ring up BT because there's a problem. And the way BT works, as far as I can see, is that they have the head honcho or whatever, and it's kind of very hierarchical, and the person you actually speak to on the phone can do nothing. Or maybe they have a very limited script, and if your thing isn't on the script, they can't do anything. They're powerless, yeah? Does that make sense? And some of the people are really helpful, I guess, their personality, but their system actually isn't that helpful. And then there's other organisations. So I should have asked the question, who's at this end? Like, who's over here? Is the customer, the patient, the client, yeah? So there are companies, there are organisations that are set up the other way around. The power is close to where the action happens. It's close to the client, it's close to the customer. And everyone's looking, when they're thinking about accountability, and this is a real, like, blow-your-mind moment, you know, they're not looking up there. They're looking at, how does this impact the customer? How does it impact the patient? How does it impact the person who I actually really care about? The reason I went into this job was to make a difference to these people. Yeah? So we switch the whole thing on its head. But, of course, we have all these systems and measurement processes and the way performance is managed that looks upwards. Yeah? Sorry? Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Yeah. 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 It's particularly, well, and in a really good local authority, like really good members, they're actually over here, aren't they? You know, they're kind of picking up the thing that's happening on the street. They want sort of, not all local authorities or not all members are quite as voter centric, maybe. I don't know. It probably depends on the size of their majority or something, you know. So the idea I really want to kind of leave you with there is just this idea that you can think of accountability as something which faces the customer, the patient, the client. And there are organisations out there that have built that in. So I know of one organisation that if you're doing some work and you suppose, for example, you've come across an issue like the nurse I mentioned earlier, and she's thought, I mentioned that idea 3 months ago, it's still not happened. Then actually they've built in a system where that person can actually, they have a system of a card they can play. It's like a green card where you can play your card. I think it's like 3 times a year or something. Can say, I want a sit down meeting with my boss and somebody else more, even more senior in the organisation, because this is stopping me doing the thing for the customer, for the patient, that we want to do as an organisation. And of course, what it does, it means that manager who's normally looking upwards actually starts to think, crikey, I'd better look this way as well. Now, of course, a lot of people were doing that anyway, but it just changes the flow in a fundamental way. Okay, so on the home straight now, last bit. I'd like to do something. Just this paper in the middle and these pens. Just write down. Imagine you're recruiting a new team member and you've got a choice over the sort of person that comes to work for you. Write down a strength or a quality that you would like to see in that person, okay? So, for example, I tend to like people who are very straight-talking and tell it as it is, and that's what I might want. So just take a moment, and I would like you to write something down, okay? So just grab a pen, a bit of paper. Take a moment to do that. Okay, has everyone written something down? I just want to hear one or two of these things. I should have actually told you to look through the cards, actually. I'd forgotten to put them out on the tables. If you're struggling, you can take the cards there, look through, and it's 52 different strengths or qualities. Let's just hear some of the things that you would like to see in a new team member. Somebody shout something out. Creative, over here, okay. Adaptable, yeah. What else? Loyal. Couldn't hear that. Collaborative, yeah. Resilience. Creative. We had creative there. You two should get together. Creative. Snap. That's his idea. Okay, brilliant. And those are all really positive qualities, aren't they? Now, I just want to... I'm just going to present something, but just remember what you said, and that's why I want you to write it down, because I'm going to come back to it in a moment. So... yeah, I want to talk about this whole thing about strength and diversity, or strengths and inclusion. I'm going to change that too for my next presentation. This idea that in a really high-performing team, everyone gets to play to their strengths. We use the strengths of the whole team, not just some strengths. And of course, what happens in reality is that we tend to be more attracted to working with people who are a little bit like us. Yeah? So... hands up, and this isn't, I don't want to put you too much on the spot, but just be honest, if you look at what you wrote down, okay, is it more like you, or is it kind of the opposite of you? Yeah? So, like, I like straight talking, and my business partner is smooth, charming, but I'm not. Okay, I get into trouble all the time, you know. He's the opposite of me, and we work really well as a team, it's amazing. But what... you know, what I immediately think of when somebody says, what sort of people do you like to work with, Dave, is somebody who's straight talking. Yeah. So did you write down something that's more similar to this? So hands up if you wrote down something that's quite similar to you in some way. Okay. More than half the room. Hands up if you wrote down something that's really different than you. Okay. So there you go. So you're the exception. So this is really interesting. There is a basic psychological kind of setup in our minds that we're more attracted to working with people who are like us. Now, I was dealing in qualities there, like, you know, sort of, if you like, cognitive abilities or something. But actually, the same is true in all sorts of other ways, you know, culturally, socially. There's all sorts of ways that, and there's all sorts of devious experiments that psychologists do to show this is true, that we're more attracted to working with people who are more similar to us. Doesn't mean necessarily they look like us, but they might have some similar set of values or similar set of ways of working. And yet the evidence is that teams are much more effective when we include all sorts of different ways of working. So a lot of you here will have done Belbin team styles, yeah? It's Belbin team styles, that ringing bell. And I don't know if people know the background to that, but when Meredith Belbin set out, and I think it was in the 70s, the premise he was starting from is that the most effective teams were the teams with the cleverest people, okay? So the idea was, if you put a bunch of clever people in a room to do a task, and then put a bunch of not quite so clever people in the next room to do a task, that actually the clever people would perform best. And he was doing the research just to kind of put a line under that and say, yeah, we've proven that. Everyone knows that. We've just got the evidence now to back it up. And I actually found it just wasn't true. And he spent the next 4 or 5 years trying to figure out, well, if it's not that, what is it? And what he discovered was actually it was teams that have a huge diversity of different ways of thinking and working. And there is all sorts of evidence out there that different forms of diversity. And again, I had a conversation actually with, is it Lindbergh, the chap this morning was talking about inclusion, that where you've got great diversity, particularly where that diversity is appreciated and respected and included, you get high levels of performance. And what we have to do is kind of remember that. So when we're recruiting, when we're thinking about team members, actually finding people who are really different than us is going to make a real difference. And it's also that's also true, not just for cognitive abilities, but also thinking about gender, thinking about different social backgrounds. It adds a richness to our thinking. So, okay, I'm probably going to about run out of time, so I've just got one more thing I want to do. So I'd just like to draw your attention to the cards on the table, because I realise I haven't mentioned those, and they're about to finish. So if you have a look at the cards on the table, this is a tool we use to get people thinking about different qualities. So if you get the cards out of the pack, and if you take the cards, you'll see that on the cards, each card has got a positive quality. So it allows us to have a conversation about different strengths, which is a really interesting conversation to have with any team. Yeah, we can have a conversation with a team about different people's strengths, and actually it's very empowering, it's very energising for the team. But we've also got on each card what I call the flip side, you know, an overplayed strength. So somebody, for example, in this case that's very ambitious, they set challenging goals, might find it really difficult to relax, and I'm sure we've all been around people like that. Okay. But then what we've also got is, if you look at the cards, they're in pairs. And this is really interesting, because it actually allows us to have these conversations about diversity, about including people who are opposite to us. So you'll see, if you take the pairs of twos there, two of clubs is easygoing, two of spades is ambitious. And those are opposites. They're kind of opposite types of people. And the chances are those people in the team will rub each other the wrong way. And in fact, I do a lot of work in teams where I'm resolving some kind of conflict. And often, I do a game with people where I get people to choose their top cards and another person chooses the top cards. And it's amazing how many times people have got the opposite card. But rather than seeing that those qualities are all needed in the team, what they see is you're a problem. So so probably the best example is the two red tens. Ten of hearts is big picture. Ten of diamonds is detail. And I was working with, again, two very senior people in an organisation just last week, where the chief executive was a big picture thinker, thinking about the big picture, where the organisation's going. His chief of operations, very detailed. And actually, rather than seeing, actually, this really complements, it's fantastic. They were seeing each other as the problem. They were seeing each other as the other's behaviour as a problem. So there's all sorts of things you can do there. I've probably run out of time, I think, to kind of do any more with that. Yeah. Because I think I've got to leave a little bit of time for questions. Okay, so I'm going to skip through all that, because I think I'll be run out of time. But there's lots of things we can do with those cards, and I use those as a tool to get people thinking about how they communicate, get people thinking about diversity, get people thinking about strengths. So we've got a few minutes left for some questions. So any questions?
Yeah.
Oh, the advice frame. Yeah, let me go back to that. Yeah, okay. Was it this slide? The advice frame. Yeah. So this is something, again, we use a lot, because what happens, of course, when you start saying to people, we want to empower people on the front line to make decisions, first of all, the managers freak out because they go, whoa, hang on, what if people get things wrong? But also, the people who are being told, you can now make decisions, also kind of can feel really nervous. They can feel a sense of, am I going to do something and get clobbered? Because that's maybe what I'm used to happening. And so an approach we found really useful, and again, we didn't make this up, we kind of got this from kind of best practice in other parts of the world, is what we call the advice frame. So if the normal situation at the frontline organisation, and the front line can go a long way up, if you know what I mean, is that people feel they need permission. I can't do that because I don't think I feel that I've got permission. One of the things you can do is create what we call an advice frame. And the advice frame is really simple. So what you do, you draw a frame and you basically say, anything outside the frame, you can't take a decision about. We want you to go through the normal managerial channels. So I did this with a group of nurses, and the advice frame they had, the thing that was outside the frame, was anything about money, anything about changing clinical standards, and anything about hiring and firing people. But that leaves loads of stuff inside the frame. It's like, if it's not outside the frame, it's inside the frame. And so they wanted to make decisions about things like, well, can we train up an extra person to use that particular machine? Because sometimes there's only one person who uses it, and sometimes she's away. So if we had two people, we could provide better cover. Just get on with it. It doesn't need to... Exactly, yeah, that's exactly it. You know, and the second part of the advice frame, because that's kind of just kind of drawing up a list of this is in, this is out, you know. The second part is the advice bit, and this is really important. So what we also create is, you don't have to do this on your own, but go and ask advice, not permission, but advice. I think it'd be really good to split the drug trolley round in half. What do other people think? Yeah, and we maybe put around that a generic kind of like, always ask a peer, always ask someone who doesn't know anything about it, because they might have a different view. And of course, what happens is it leaves somebody feeling more confident, like, I can make a decision and I'm not on my own. I've got a sense of, I've talked to Manny, you know, I've talked to, you know, John or whatever, and they didn't throw their hands up in horror, so maybe this is okay. But it also creates a load of learning, you know, because what happens, of course, is you go and ask someone what they think, and they'll say, that's a really good idea. Maybe we should be doing that. Or they say, well, actually, we did try something quite similar in this other ward, and there was this reason it didn't work. So what, of course, you do, you create those connections, you break down the silos, actually, in all sorts of different ways. So it's an incredibly simple and incredibly powerful way of creating a different type of conversation around permission. Yeah? Thanks for that question. That's really good. Yeah. Anything else? Probably got time for one more question, I think. No, we're all desperate to get off for a cup of coffee. Okay, thank you all very much.